Well, it is a great pleasure this week to interview Steve Jacobs for my latest Nostalgia interview. And Steve, of course, we've known each other for many, many years because we were both at Lampeter 91 to 94.
That's correct.
Yeah. And so you did religious studies and I did theology, but our paths really have dovetailed over the years.
They have in quite an extraordinary way, haven't they, in many ways. Do you remember getting the results? I mean, they were kind of sellotaped onto the window of a department, and you walk down that long drive, you know, that path that led to the RS department, and everybody was looking at the results. Yeah. It was quite a strange way of announcing. But Chris Arthur was sitting up in his office, and he saw me come up the path, and he literally dashed down the door to congratulate me.
Those were really lovely, almost like quaint days, because these days you wouldn't be allowed to do that because obviously all our marks were available for anyone, not just other students. They were on the door of that, it was a converted house.
Yes.
And so anybody could see that. And the results, I remember, came out a bit early. And I remember a couple of friends happened to be going down to the co-op. And they saw the results, and they obviously saw what they got and very happy. But they carried on, did their shop, which I find quite sort of almost like funny in itself, and then came back and they said to me, "Oh, have you seen your result?" And I was like, "No, I said it's not available for another hour." And they said, "I think you need to go." So I literally ran down all the way to Printel. I said, you know, I was a bit fitter in those days. And we were all gathered there. So almost I wanted to get a ruler out just to make sure. misread the line because I was trying to, you know, take all this in. But yeah, that was gosh, almost 30 years ago now. And so do you want to say a bit more? Because obviously you have worked until quite recently at Wolverhampton, and I always think of you, of course, as a religious studies specialist, which of course you are, but you am I right in thinking that for a while you were also working in media?
Yes, you are right. I mean, it's quite a convoluted history. I got appointed to Wolverhampton almost immediately after completing my PhD to the religious studies department, where I work with the fantastic George Chrysides, but I was on a fixed term contract for 2 years initially, and religious studies wasn't well supported at Wolverhampton at the time, and our student numbers were declining slightly. So at the end of the 2 years, an associate dean who shall not be named told George in a corridor, "We're no longer going to support religious studies as a full-time degree subject, and we're going to cut you down to just offering it as a joint. And consequently, you do not need 3 members of staff, so we're not going to renew Steve's contract." So I went, "Oh, that's very nice." But at the time, Wolverhampton was also going through a bit of a crisis more generally, and they'd actually made some redundancies. So the deal was, if there was any vacancies, they had to be offered internally first. And there just so happened to be 2 vacancies in the media department. So I thought, well, nothing ventured, nothing gained. So because I had done Chris Arthur's religion and the media module in my undergraduate at Lampeter, which I really enjoy, and one of the really groundbreaking at the time, I thought, well, I wonder if I can blag my way into the media department. So I successfully managed to do it, although it was a bit difficult because the head of the department didn't really like me, didn't really like academics particularly. But I was very much supported by the associate dean at the time, and they gave me the post. So I then moved full time from media, from religious studies into teaching media and cultural studies.
Yeah, quite ironic then for the head of a department in a university who doesn't like academics. Yeah, I can imagine that was a fraught relationship. But it's funny what you said about Chris Arthur, because of course he was my PhD supervisor and I did all this stuff on religion and film. But I remember not doing that module on religion and media, because for me it was a toss-up, kind of funny looking back, between religion and the media, which perhaps I should have done, and Christianity to AD 461 with Reverend Selwyn, and it's right. So funny, which was actually a really good grounding, because I used a lot of sort of Christology stuff in my work on film, but it's so funny. I remember that day going to see Chris Arthur in probably the summer after my first year, and I was really torn between those two modules, but it was almost like, you know, what you mentioned, nothing ventured, nothing gained. It's almost like what comes around, you know, sort of goes around all the other way around, because somehow it was almost like that wasn't my moment. But a few years later, you know, Chris was, but the first time I really had anything to do with Chris was when he supervised me for my PhD. So, you know, I stayed in Lampeter, but it was sort of fresh, because I had a completely new kind of methodological lens with which to work. But it's funny how things work out.
It was a very interesting module, that, because my main interest was, of course, Indian religions. And we might come on to that in a minute. And I wanted to avoid doing religious studies, anything to do with the prophetic traditions. So I ended up, well, I'm not that interested in the media, but I, you know, I'd had Chris Arthur in the first year on his study of religion, the methodology module or whatever it was called back then. And I like Chris, and I really liked his pedagogical style. And I thought, well, okay, that's one module that will avoid generally doing something on Christianity or Islam or Judaism. And I actually became, it actually was one of the most interesting modules I did in the whole time that I was at Lampeter. It was just, and it was so groundbreaking, because there was virtually no literature on it at all at the time. It was Chris's edited book and a couple of others, but very, very little. And now, of course, there's just this mass of literature on media and religion. It's just proliferated in those, you know, couple of decades, incredibly. So yeah, I did really enjoy that module, and that was the basis of me thinking, well, I might have, you know, half a shot at going for the media post.
Yeah. No, well, and it, you know, it just goes to show, doesn't it? Because it's those decisions that we make, often sort of random decisions, but yeah. In retrospect, they don't seem random. It's almost like it's destiny. It is almost as though, you know, in making that decision once, suddenly a whole pathway opens up 10, 20 years later. And, yeah. and I found that so much during my career, you know, I mean, you know, how I ended up doing a PhD on film when, I didn't really start going to the cinema until I was a student. You know, I said it was something I just didn't do when I was growing up. So it's like almost like overcompensation. It's like in your case, you know, you choose this module, which perhaps is a little bit different from anything else you were doing. But then you ended up, that becomes the sort of bedrock of your career, or the second half of your career anyway.
Yeah, but then just going back to that. And then, so I was purely in media and cultural studies for, gosh, I don't know how many, about 8 years or something. And then Pindachit Takhar, who had joined the team by that point, had started this Centre for Punjabi and Sikh Studies. Absolutely brilliant what she's doing at the moment. And so because of that, she went down to doing 0.5 teaching, and they needed to have somebody 0.5 in religious studies. So I said, well, you know, it's crazy. Why appoint somebody from outside? You've got me. And that, my line manager had changed over the course of the time, and my current line manager then was very supportive, and he agreed to let 0.5 of me go. So in the last 5-6 years, I suppose it was, I was 50-50, doing 50% media studies stuff, 50% in the religious studies department, which was absolutely perfect for me.
Yeah, as worth. Talking about Chris Arthur, I always remember the first sort of advice he gave me in the first meeting I had was that some of the best research is at the cutting edge between disciplines. So it's that sort of when you're at the cusp between one area and another. And in a way, what you did, and I guess I did, because I didn't do anything on media prior to doing the PhD, is sort of suddenly find that a whole new set of doors really are opened up. And it sounds as though it kind of all worked out. It may not have been your plan, but it sounds as though
bumbled through somehow. Yeah. While we're on Chris, I should say something about Chris, because I had, well, my life at the point of coming to Lampeter was on this kind of cycle. I was working for a place called the Centre for Alternative Technology, running their kitchens. And then when I got fed up of it, I'd quit and go and spend 6 months in India and then come back. And I was getting a bit tired of that cycle, and I thought, well, what else should I do? And I'd just come back from quite a long trip to India, and I really thought I need to do something else. So I thought, well, I live in Mahuncliffe, which is, as you know, not far from Lampeter. And so I thought, well, I'll go and find out what their religious studies department was all about, because having traveled to India so often, I was really fascinated by the religious culture, if you like, of the subcontinent. And I turned up at Chris Arthur's, made an appointment to see Chris, who was the admissions tutor at the time. I turned up with, you know, really long hair, you know.
I remember.
And we had this amazing chat in his office. And I told him, look, you know, this is what I've been doing. I dropped out of school. I hadn't got any A levels, you know, and I was just kind of interested what it might be, you know, possibilities of coming to study there. And we were in his office, probably getting on for an hour. And I said, well, if I wanted to come and study here, what would I have to do? And he said, and I was expecting him to say, oh, write me an essay to show that you can write, or do an access course before you come or something. And he said to me, because I was a mature student, I was in my mid-30s when I started my degree. And he said, oh, no, you just fill in an UCAS form and you can come next semester. And so that's what I did. I filled in. Lampeter was the only place to put on the form. And he gave me that chance. He gave me that opportunity.
Yeah, because I remember meeting you, and of course you were a little bit older than me, but you had this huge background, because I remember the India trips, and you know, you had something that I even to this day, because I've only ever really worked in academia, or certainly I've always, you know, my primary job has always been in the university sector, but you had life experience, and that was very clear from the conversations that you had, and I guess that was probably a really good background to you in terms of doing the degree, because am I right in thinking that your PhD was very much on Hinduism?
Yeah, it was on late 19th century and early 20th century Hindu reform movements. If somebody had come to me today and suggested my PhD topic, I would send them away. It was too big, but somehow it got accepted. Because I really wanted to answer what was then not really fully explored, but why do Hindus think of themselves as Hindus, and why is Hinduism considered a religion that can both be compared and contrasted with other religions? And the kind of background of that is quite difficult, because on one level, you could argue that Hinduism is the oldest of the kind of so-called world religions, although, of course, we now kind of challenge that paradigm, in that it can trace its origins back possibly to the Indus Valley civilization, which is 2,500 BC, although that date is disputed. But on the other hand, the term Hinduism as a religion was only first used, as far as we know, at the end of the 18th century. And it was only first used by a Hindu, somebody called Raja Ramohan Roy, in the 19th century. So the conceptualization of Hinduism as a religion, you could argue, only began in the 19th century. And there's lots of literature now about this debate, but it hadn't been fully explored at the time that I decided to do my PhD.
Yeah, and that often happens, doesn't it? That sometimes you're working on a project, and then, you know, decades later, you think, gosh, that actually doesn't really fit. I mean, I did a PhD on film, and kind of was aware that I was using certain paradigms that were quite very Christian-centric in many ways. Yeah. And I guess that's my background. But at the same time, I would look at that now, and even in my teaching, and be very aware that perhaps there, you know, the word diversity would certainly appear, and I think I would frame that PhD very differently. But also, there's a part of me that thinks, well, you know, it was a product of its time, and there's, you know, there's nothing wrong with that. It's just the fact that if I was doing it now, it couldn't be the same PhD. But it's interesting what we think we're doing cutting edge stuff, but good work engenders other good work by other scholars. And then, you know, I look at some of the stuff being written, even by my own students, it must be said, undergraduate students. And I sometimes think, wow, you know, they're thinking on a completely different sort of plane, you know, and it's funny sometimes to think just how there was a paucity of work, certainly in my area, back in the 90s when I started in this. And you're right, Chris Arthur's book on religion and media, and he published something around 93, and that was, you know, at the time that was seen to be pretty cutting edge, really, because you know, religion and media, you'd really struggle to find much literature, as I know from experience from going to the library. I maybe it was the same with you, but it was very much dependent on interlibrary loans in order to get through my doctorate.
Oh God, yeah, I think I broke the religious studies budget on interlibrary loans.
Yeah.
I mean, PhDs are funny things, really. I mean, you know, kind of looking back at it, mine is so flawed in many ways, but it was a training ground. I think you need to see these things much more as process rather than product. And I think we've lost sight of that in education more generally, because the discourse around higher education is all about employability.
Yeah.
Now, yes, obviously students need to be, you know, employable and hopefully get graduate style jobs, but that's all it's become. And the idea of education as a process rather than a product, I think we've completely lost sight of that. And I think that's really sad.
Yeah, and I think that when I decided in the days when we had grants to go to university, it never occurred to me really to make a connection with employability. I didn't really think, you know, in doing this degree, it's going to lead directly anyway to a particular outcome. And it's sort of naive really looking back, but also I kind of look back as almost a kind of pre-lapsarian period. That's the theologian in me. But it was, because I had the chance to go to the place that I wanted to go to do the degree that I wanted. And it was because I wanted to flourish, and it was a love of learning. And, you know, and I did it for its own sake. And, you know, and these days students have to make strategic decisions based on geography and family and work and money. And sometimes the sort of luxuries that we had really didn't apply.
Yeah, I mean, I very much saw it as a 3-year lacuna, you know, as a, you know, break, you know, time to stop and think and reflect and engage with debates and issues. I never dreamt that it would take me on to do a doctorate and then ultimately, you know, working in academia. And it was very much, and I didn't really care in some ways, you know, obviously I wanted to do well, but it didn't matter that much.
Yeah. And but tell me a bit more about the antecedents, because I remember this now, that you were working, you were doing lots of culinary work, weren't you? And you was it an outdoors centre, a vegan centre, is that right?
Okay, right. So when I went to a school which was the best school. I come from a very middle class background. My father was the local GP. My mother was the doctor's wife. I was reasonably intelligent, not to want to be accused of hubris, and I got into what was the Nottingham High School for Boys. So I was born and raised in Nottingham. And I quite liked the first year, and then it went downhill from there. And I just about, I don't know how I managed to do it, scraped enough O levels to get into the A level course. And I hated it. So I basically dropped out. This is right at the tail end of the counterculture. And then I was doing odd jobs here and there. And then it became more and more difficult just to pick up a job by looking at the local paper. And I'd always enjoyed cooking. So I went to a catering college and I got a catering qualification. And then that meant that I could work. And I worked in everything from West End restaurants to oil rigs.
That's eclectic.
Yeah, yeah. And I'd just come back from, I think, my longest trip from India, which was a year and a half. And I was living in London with some friends and things were not working out for me there for various reasons. So I thought, well, I'll look for work outside of London. And I just happened to be browsing through the Vegetarian magazine for job opportunities, because by that point I'd already become a vegetarian. And there was a job advertised for a place called the Centre for Alternative Technology in Mahoncliffe. So again, nothing ventured, nothing gained. So I popped on a train, and I think I was the only person who'd applied for the job running their restaurant. It was called Restaurant Coordinator at the time, who'd actually got a catering qualification. So I got the post. So I moved from London to Wales, and that was a big eye-opener. I think there were three critical points in my life: going to India, working for the Centre for Alternative Technology, and also starting my degree. It was just a different environment, and I loved living in the country. For those of you who don't know, the Centre for Alternative Technology just celebrating its 50th year. And it was an educational centre to try and promote what we would now call, although that terminology wasn't widely used at the time, sustainable living. And so it was an exhibition. It was open to the public. It offered short courses on wind power, water power, organic gardening, those sorts of things. But it also had a small site community. And I was part of that site community. So as well as working there, I actually lived there. Not everybody who worked there lived on site, but there was about half of us at the time actually lived on site. We shared resources, although we all had individual kind of units of accommodation. So I lived in a large caravan at one end of the site. And so I ran their vegetarian kitchens for a number of years. And they also had a cafe in town. So I started up at the site itself. And it was incredible because we had a kitchen not much bigger than my office here. We would, on a busy summer's day, we would get like 800-900 people passing through.
And when you then did your degree, did you continue those links, or did you become a full time student and then sort of go into a different zone?
Yeah. I mean, that was definitely. I was really a bit tired of working in kitchens, and I think if you work as a chef, you've got to enjoy it. Mm. And I'd ceased enjoying it, and that's when I went to see Chris, and he gave me, you know, a place. And I, except in the summer when I needed a bit of chump change, I would go and work in their cafe. But yeah. I more or less gave up on them until fairly recently. But that's another long and convoluted story. My latest monograph is actually way outside of religious studies. And I wrote a short monograph for Routledge on sustainable living at the Centre for Alternative Technology.
But you see, it's the way that all of these decisions, I'm a big believer in this, that sometimes, you know, we all, wherever we go, we make decisions to go to a particular university or not to go. Or in your case, obviously, you went a bit later. And it's, I always think of my grandfather, actually, who never went to university. He was born in 1920. And so, you know, he was involved in the war, you know, at the time that, you know, he would have been university age. And that was one of his big regrets. And I think he saw what myself and my sister did, who was also at Lampeter, as kind of almost like the opportunity that he never had. But it's the way in which sometimes, like, you were doing one thing, you left it in order to become a religious studies student, and then obviously you become an academic. And then in your retirement, you write a book, which you couldn't have done if it hadn't been for that particular, you know, interregnum, or whatever you want to call it, in that period before you did your degree. That's actually a beautiful sort of way of bringing it all together. It kind of, it fits, you know, it, what feel like rambling, you jokingly said, you know, bumbling along, but actually it to me, listening to your narrative, there's perfect synchronicity in that.
Yeah. I've been thinking, I mean, when you get to, actually, I did the book before I retired on a Lever Hume grant, but that, I mean, that's just the minutiae. And of course, when you get to retirement, you're getting up to retirement, you start kind of, you know, reflecting on all of the choices you've made. And, you know, from the outside, you know, it looks like they're very different choices. They're very different kind of phenomena, you know, working in a kitchen and working in academia. But so I've been thinking about, and one of the things that I've been thinking about recently, but really unifies those two aspects of my life, if you like, is the concept of sharing. You know, when we're thinking about academia, which is primarily both teaching and research, what's it about? It's about sharing ideas. But so is working in the kitchen. It's about sharing. And this idea really kind of grew out of some of the things I was thinking about when I was writing the monograph about the Centre for Alternative Technology. So I think that's a kind of unifying theme, really.
Yeah, I think that's really well put, because my way of looking at it, when I first went to university, you know, I was 18, and, you know, my whole education had been framed by the school curriculum rather than any sort of life experience. And of course, it was always about who are the most important people who are writing the books in the, you know, if you're on Marxism or whatever, you know, you'd go to the go-to people. You'd read all the important scholars, primary and secondary. And then you'd regurgitate that in some way, you'd process it, and you'd submit an essay that quotes this person and that person, that expert, that expert. So you become almost a mini expert because you've spent 2 weeks or however long we used to, you know, spend on an essay, indulging in all these great published authors. And of course, now 30 or more years on, I start to see that that model has its place. And you need the undergirding to do a degree in something. You need to know what the experts think. Yeah. But actually, that then, you know, becomes perhaps the starting point rather than the end point. And I think the whole sort of top down, bottom up trajectory is something that, not least to all the nostalgia work and the turn to the self and the subjective turn, you know, has been really interesting. Actually, not just looking at the so-called experts, but what are all, you know, so-called ordinary people, you know, we're all ordinary people in a way, you know, people who go to the cinema like myself, you know, what are they making of all of these sort of paradigms and so on? And other, do those paradigms work because a particular scholar has told us it did? And then students like me once upon a time would have just regurgitated that and presented it. And then a few years or decades later, presented it to my own students. And often it's through my own students. I'm sure you've had this as well, that you're teaching a class. And sometimes the students say, we don't like this author, and then suddenly they explain why, and something clicks, and I think you're right, but I put them on a pedestal.
I mean, one of the things that's really very strong, I think, in my work, and it's only kind of emerged after I left Lampeter and started to work in at Wolverhampton, and my research took on a different trajectory in many ways. My research at for my PhD was entirely archival and book based. I gradually moved, which is interesting because, you know, obviously my experience of traveling around India is much more kind of ethnographic. But I kind of moved much more towards ethnography. And one of the things that really interested me, didn't interest students so much, was the theory of ethnography and how we do it, how we practice it, and our position in the field. And so, very much influenced by feminist standpoint theory, that we always approaching our subject from a particular standpoint, just to cut a long story short, and that one should be very upfront about. And, you know, certainly in the two later monographs, I've tried quite carefully, without kind of going into too much detail, set my stall out saying, this is who I am, and this is where I'm coming on, and this is my approach to this particular topic.
And I suppose, in a way, the sort of education that we had at Lampeter kind of framed that, I guess, because maybe we don't do the same thing now that we did, or our tutors did 30 years ago, but we're drawing on that. And without that, I always say that to my students, sometimes you need to know the basics. You might want to contest it. A lot of it is very male-centric and Eurocentric, etc. But actually, once you know that, then you can critique it. Critique something until you kind of know what you're critiquing, or at least it's a very different way of direction of travel, which would involve a different sort of mindset, really.
Yeah, I mean, it is a different mindset. And, you know, again, I was, in fact, stimulated by your invitation, was thinking about this. And I kind of briefly alluded to it earlier, but I think there's the four kind of important points in my life. One is taking psychedelics. Two is traveling to India. Three is starting to work for the Center for Alternative Technology. And four is embarking on my academic career. Well, all of those four things taught me, I think, was about you can look at the world in very, very different ways. Yeah. And it's to be able to understand. I mean, I don't really want to go into phenomenology, but that kind of empathize with why somebody might think about the world in very, very different ways. I mean, when I first traveled to India, it was just incredibly bewildering. It was this totally, totally different culture. It was built on a very, you know, develops from a very different worldview from, you know, kind of European post-Enlightenment thought. And, you know, trying to make sense of that becomes really important. And even if you don't agree with it, then you can see, well, I can see the sense in it. I see where it's coming from.
Yeah. So do you want to say a bit more then about your experience of going to India?
Okay. So I was young. I was probably in my early 20s. And, you know, I was a bit lost. I was having fun. I was partying, doing all the things that, you know, kind of late teens, early 20s. And I got on a bus and I thought, oh, I'll go traveling. I had been a bit traveling before. I'd been to work on a kibbutz when I was 18 for 8 months. And that kind of gave me a bit of a taste for traveling. And so a few years later, I thought, oh, I just need to go somewhere. So I literally got on a bus from Nottingham to Athens, 2 days. And I think I spent about 3 or 4 weeks wandering around various parts of Greece. And I came back to Athens and I wasn't quite ready to go home. And I literally walked past a travel agent and it said, tickets to Bombay, as it was then called, £90. I thought, well, I've got £90. So, and I had a friend who'd been in India and said they had a really fantastic time. So I went into this travel agent and I bought a one-way ticket to Bombay. It flew out a couple of days later and I was wandering around Athens going, what have I done? I don't know anything. I had no understanding of India, no background in India at all, except for this one friend who'd been and had a good time. What the hell am I doing? Anyway, so I ended up flying out to Bombay and we arrived early in the morning and I literally knew nothing, absolutely nothing. And this was the days before Lonely Planet and all that stuff. So they didn't exist at all. And then, of course, going through Bombay early in the morning, I'd just come from Athens. I thought, I don't really want to be in a city. Oh, my friend was in Goa, of course. That was the place to everybody went. So I ended up on and I was so ignorant. I thought Goa was just like Blackpool, you know, place with a beach. Didn't realize it was actually a state, admittedly, in Indian terms, a state. So I ended up, it was actually really funny. I was in the main town, which is called Margo or Mapsa sometimes in Goa. I just got off the train and I was looking around for somewhere to get somewhere else. And I saw these kind of this office and it said, oh, bus. And I thought, oh, can I get a bus to this beach, which was called Arjuna Beach? And it turned out they would take me to Arjuna Beach, but it was actually an Indian tourist bus. So Indian tourists were going around Goa and they're going to various temples and churches because there's a lot of churches in Goa, big Christian influence from the Portuguese. But part of the journey was to go and see the hippie beach. Yeah. So they dropped me off at this beach and I stayed a couple of weeks there and I thought, oh, this is really nice, but have I really come halfway around the world, you know, to just sit on a really beautiful beach and, you know, party? And so I ended up, and I wanted to go to this place called Hampi. And I got the wrong train and I ended up going south. And that was at a time when nobody went to the south of India. You know, the traveling scene was mostly around Goa, on Rajasthan, Delhi, up in Kashmir. And so I spent about 8 months making my way down the west coast from Goa, places like Mysore in Karnataka, and then into Madurai in Tamil Nadu. I made my way right down to the southern tip and up to Chennai. It took me 8 months to do, and I traveled almost exclusively on my own. And in places like Madurai, there were maybe one or two other Western tourists. So I was all the time interacting with local people. And I just loved it. It was just bonkers, you know. This whole culture was just so different from anything I'd experienced. I got to Madras, as it was then called, after 8 months, and I ran out of money. So I thought, well, I could just spend my bit that I'd got on the side for an air ticket home and just wonder how I get home later. But I decided that I didn't really want the insecurity of not knowing that I had the possibility of flying home if necessary. So I made a train journey up from Madras to Delhi, which is like 36 hours or something. flew home, and then for the next year and a half or so, I spent my time trying to get enough money to go back to India. So then about a year and a half, 2 years later, flew back to India with much better understanding of what I was doing. And again, I was in South India, I think. No, I was on the east coast of India in Puri, which is on the east coast. And I was thinking of going to do some yoga because I'd done a little bit of yoga on my first trip, and I was interested in learning more about it. And I was going to go up to this place called Dharamsala up in the north of India. And there was another traveler in Puri who was a yoga teacher. And he said, no, don't go up to Dharamsala. The guru has gone mad. He said, why don't you go to this place called Rishikesh, which is a bit further south. It's just kind of northeast of Delhi on the banks of the Ganges. Northeast, northwest. Can't remember my geography. So I went there, and they were running this. There was an ashram there called the Shivananda Ashram that had been started by a guru in the 1950s called Swami Shivananda. And they were offering three-month courses in yoga and Vedantas. Vedantas, both yoga and Vedanta are types of Hindu philosophy. Yoga, of course, is a practice as well. And I said, well, can I join this course? And they said, well, okay, what we want you to do, and it was very clever, I thought, they said, write us a short essay, a couple of hundred words, it wasn't much, on why you want to do this course. And so I thought, well, again, nothing ventured, nothing gained. So I went back to the lodgings where I was, and I wrote, 200, 300 words or whatever of why I thought I should do this course. And that was obviously good enough for them. So they let me on this course. And it was a very intensive 3 months, course. I was one of the last courses that they allowed non-Indians to do. So I was very, very lucky. And so, you get up in the morning, we would then do an hour's of a physical yoga postures, then we would have breakfast. And then what I really kind of resonated with me was the really academic approach they had. So we'd have 2 hours of classes on philosophy in the morning. We'd then have lunch, and then 2 hours of lectures on various aspects of Hindu philosophy in the afternoon. And then an hour meditation. And then in the evening, we were expected to join the rest of the course, the rest of the ashram. It's a very big ashram for what's called satsang, which is like a kind of, cut a long story short, congregational worship. And that finished about 9 o'clock. Next morning, you get up 4 o'clock in the morning. So that was every day, except for we had weekends off for 3 months. So it was a pretty full-on experience.
Yeah. How long were you there for altogether?
In India, that time, a year and a half. When the course had finished, they kind of encouraged you to leave. And I spent a little bit longer there. And then I decided that I wanted to spend some more time in the area. So I found a room locally. And in the evening, I would go up to the satsang if I felt like it. Other than that, I would just drink chai and watch the river Ganges, which is just beautiful there. Yeah. It's a very beautiful part of India. It's called the Siwalik Hills. And above it is Devbhumi, the land of the gods. And I didn't make it that trip, but the next trip I went up to, because there's 4 very important pilgrimage places up in the Himalayas. So I did make it up to Gangotri in April when there was still 2 foot of snow on the ground. So a lot of pilgrims go through Rishikesh en route. It is itself a pilgrimage place, but mostly pilgrims are going en route to these other important pilgrimage places.
Have you returned over the years? I'm guessing that might have kick-started further pilgrimages, or is it a sort of locked in stone kind of, this was also, a lot of people feel that way about Lampeter. It's sort of like it's a particular memory, and you kind of want it to remain in your head exactly as you remember it and experienced it.
No, I've returned many times. In fact, the last time I returned, Pinderjit and Graham Harvey from the Open University are doing a series of books. Well, Graham is doing the series, and he asked Pinderjit to do it on religion and senses of place. And they came to me and said, please, please, can you write something for us? And I said, I don't know, I'm a bit busy at the moment. I don't know. And you know, Pinderjit's very persuasive. I said, okay. And I went, the last time I was back there was in 2017, just before the pandemic here. And I loved it because I was there and I wrote a chapter for her book, which are rather, you know, arrogantly kind of called Clouds Drifting Through a Landscape. But the reasons for that. So, it's funny. There's a couple of places that have really felt like home instantly that I've been. One is when I moved from London to Mahoncliffe. I really felt at home there. And the other was when I went for the first time and my second trip to India, to Rishikesh. I just sometimes call it Desh Pardesh, which is Hindi for home from home. So I have this very strong emotional connection and friends there.
Yeah, because that's an important point, because obviously in terms of nostalgia, there's always that sort of notion of home. And it's the home that we think we had that may or may not have existed, but the people are perhaps no longer there. And you know, there's all these questions then about whether you rebuild the past, restore it, or whether it's that sort of more, it exists in our imagination. But home is an important thing, because it sounds as though along the way, you've been to places, you've made it, you know, from growing up in Nottingham, in terms of spending a long time in India, obviously then moving to West Wales, and in many cases actually building, you know, important connections and indeed, you know, life building, and obviously the Wolverhampton in later years. But it sounds as though that there are a collection of homes that you would call home.
Scattered across the globe, definitely. Yeah. I mean, Shrewsbury, where I live now, I mean, this is, you know, Judith and I have definitely made a home here. And so I think, you know, it's a very fluid idea, home. It's not just one place. It's, you know, again, kind of going back to the kind of theories and ideas that I've developed. It's about everything is all about relationships. And it's the relationships that you develop with places as much as it is with people that are important. In fact, I write about that in that chapter, because one of the things I was really interested in is, if you go to Rishikesh today, when I first went, not many people went. But now it's kind of sold itself as India's capital of yoga. So I deliberately went in August. And the reason I went in August was there's a big festival there called Shravan Mela. 15 million people pass through Rishikesh, which is not much bigger than Lampeter. During the month of this festival, you also have the kind of, dare I say, middle class, kind of relatively affluent Indians who also go to places like Shivananda Ashram. You have the local population, and you also have Westerners who are going there increasingly to study yoga. And there's some very good yoga courses and some very bad ones too. And so you have these different constituencies who all relating to this one place in very, very different ways. It's all about relationship. And in some sense, that's why I call the chapter Clouds Drifting Through a Landscape.
Yeah. Because I went through a period where, in the case of Lampeter, for example, I couldn't go back because I think I'd spent so long there. I just needed to step away and kind of work out, because there were lots of paradoxes for me, because I was doing a degree, you know, I was effectively doing a PhD on film in a town without a cinema. And so I was always sort of using Lampeter as a base for going somewhere else, you know, to the city and back. And after, it was pretty obvious after a while that I'd sort of outgrown it, really. I after 10 years, I needed to change direction, really. And then I kind of felt and feel now that I actually enjoy going back to places, because I'm just aware that on every level, you know, just by looking at photographs, looking at family members, spending time with family members, we all change of all, we get older. And yeah, there comes a point where to worry about, oh, the place may not look like it used to, I think, well, you know, I mean, I'd be a bit worried if it didn't look a bit different from how it used to look. And I think maybe there's a sort of a personal confidence in that, that I'm kind of no longer thinking I will expect to see, as I did when I went to a reunion a few years ago, you expect to see the people from my year group. Somehow I imagine I'd go back to Lamberton, they'd all be there again, a bit older, but it would be the same collection of people. And of course, none of them were there. Well, one. And that really struck me. And I thought, yeah, that's where we've all moved on. And I think for a while, I just somehow imagined that that place was indelibly linked to particular people. And I'd forgotten perhaps almost that actually people move on, and I realize that actually that is quite a liberating feeling, rather than imagining somehow that all those things that both liberated us and held us back in those days, you know, has evolved.
I mean, it's quite interesting, because I made the connection with the university, because you know, obviously, yeah, at the time, you know, there were some brilliant teachers there, you know, but I didn't have as much to do with the student body as maybe you did, because I was living, you know, 30 miles away in Mahoncliffe. But I'd been in Mahoncliffe since, oh God, 86. And when did we leave?
91.
Yeah, but I'd actually started in Mahoncliffe it was 84 I moved to Mahoncliffe. So I'd been in Mahoncliffe for a couple of decades. And then after I'd finished my PhD at Lamberton, and Judith and I had got together, I decided it was time to leave. And so we left, initially up to Lancaster, because Judith got her PhD at Lancaster. And a lot of people were really surprised. And in fact, some people have even accused Judith of dragging me away. But even if we hadn't got together, I would have left, because I had changed. I'd moved on. And that was, but I still like to go back there because I still have very good personal connections.
Yeah. Well, that's a perfect segue as we start to wrap up, Steve, because one of the questions I always ask at this point is whether your memories are predominantly positive, and linked with that whole question about, you know, what we do with negative experiences. Can we be nostalgic about them? And it's sort of, as we sort of look back and almost sort of join those dots and think, yeah, at the time that didn't work out all right, but actually based on where we are now, it was necessary in terms of character building or whatever it might be. But would you sort of say that some of those negative experiences can sometimes, actually looking back, do they feel sort of quite purposeful in a way that they might not have done at the time?
I don't know. Maybe I'm just naive, but I don't really think about them in those sorts of terms. I mean, I often compare my experiences, for example, with some of my students, you know, who are their first in their generation to get into university, and they struggle with their university degree. I also think about the fact is that I was able to kind of, in scary quotes, drop out and then drop back in again. And young people don't have that opportunity. And yet I was in that really fortunate generation, you know, my parents' generation, you know, through the war, you know, kind of baby boomer generation, catching the tail end of the counterculture, being able to almost do what I wanted. And I kind of carved this strange, you know, perambulation through, you know, various aspects of my life, and I've always managed to do whatever I've wanted to do in some ways. Yeah, I mean, it's not always been a bed of roses, you know, sometimes HE can be of challenging, but you know, even that was, you know, I know HE is going through a particular crisis at the moment, particularly in humanities subjects, particularly at Wolverhampton, but I left on a high. I left on a high that I was the first person in 6 years to get a Leverhulme Research Fellowship, finished my monograph on CAT, and I left on my terms. And I don't know how many people have that fortunate condition to be able to make those decisions on their own terms. And yet I seem to always manage to do it, and they always seem to have turned out quite well, really.
Yeah, and no, I completely see that. And indeed, in my case, I think that I have always done the projects that I've wanted to, you know, and often not with external funding. So effectively, your university, my university, is, you know, has to take a leap of faith, really. But you know, whether it's with the nostalgia stuff or the Christmas or Life After Death or the film work I've done, you know, they've always been supportive. No one's actually ever said, "Oh, you can't write that book." You know, it's effectively you put a proposal together or you apply for study leave, and you know, generally the assumption is, well, you know what you're doing, and we trust you to do it. But I'm aware of the privileges in this profession, which, you know, there's a lot in HE which is changing and it's going through some awful turbulence at the moment, but there have been really enriching opportunities.
So I just overall I just feel very very fortunate and very blessed, you know.
And do you think your younger self would have, you know, growing up in Nottingham, could you have, because obviously you hadn't been to India at that point and you certainly hadn't been in Machynlleth or Lampeter, but would you have imagined that you'd have done what you would be doing now? What would your younger self have expected that you'd end up doing?
I had no idea, because, you know, I mean, my younger self, particularly, you know, after I dropped out of school, you know, and I went to catering college, and I did enjoy working as a chef for a long time, but I don't think I'd ever imagined what I would do. I mean, I don't know. It wasn't really part of the kind of consciousness, because it was very much live in the moment. And not really worry too much about the future. And I think that was also something very peculiar and something really fantastic about that particular period of time. But I don't think holds true anymore. That you could really live in the moment much more than you can do today.
And have you really noticed that with your own students, that, you know, in terms of their reasons for coming to university in the first place? And we were talking earlier about employability. Have you really noticed that the generation of students now really have a different set of circumstances to the privileges that we had?
Yeah, I mean, definitely, because, I mean, you know, the demographic from University of Wolverhampton, they tend to be the first people. So they're coming from West Midlands, working class family, Afro-Caribbean families, South Asian families, not necessarily, you know, the middle class South Asian families. And so they want to get a degree more than do a degree. And I completely understand that. It can be frustrating at times in the classroom. And of course, I'm sure you've seen the same with, you know, growing geopolitical and events and COVID, etc., increasing anxiety amongst young people, and understandably so. Whereas mine was just like playing, really.
Well, you see, the thing is, and I find that with my students, that they, and besides, I often don't know, because obviously the students are significantly younger than me as well. I don't really know what they're thinking when I'm teaching them. But they often feel that if you're enthusiastic about something, then that's the way in, that they'll enjoy that. They'll say, okay, he's enjoying doing this. And I say to the students often, you know, hope you enjoy the class. And of course, when you're at school, you know, if somebody said to you, you know, when you were in secondary school or something, you know, enjoy your lesson, you think, no, as if somehow we have this antipathy to learning. But actually, when you go to university level, the privilege of being there and actually doing specialist modules in with somebody who's got that kind of, you know, level of expertise, it does, you know, and I'm thinking about my own time at Lampeter as well. You know, it's a gift, really, and I'm just privileged to have stayed in this sector for so many decades.
I mean, I'm not a great fan of slogans, but, you know, the slogan of the University of Wolverhampton is the University of Opportunity. And I do think very strongly that Wolverhampton was a place that gave students the opportunity to engage in the humanities and the arts. And what really worries me is that no longer is the case, or will be quickly shut down, where people from non-traditional backgrounds are able to engage in, you know, critical analytical thinking, engage in the culture, engage in the arts.
And do you find, are you in touch with many people from all those different, you know, I mean, obviously your time in India and indeed at Machynlleth was pre-social media, but have you managed to keep in touch, you know, coming from a generation that includes me, where we'd have to write letters to people, or, you know, we'd have to make sure that we wrote down their addresses. And of course,
I'm talking of letters. I know you wanted to wrap up. When my dad died, we were unpacking his office. And do you remember aerograms?
I heard of them, yeah.
Okay, aerograms were really thin blue paper that you folded up, and the outside bit, once you folded it up, was like the envelope, and it had a, you know, printed stamp on it and stuff like that. Well, over the various visits to India, every now and again, I would write my parents an aerogram. So over kind of 4 or 5 trips, maybe there was maybe 8 or 9 of these letters, you know, very, and he kept them all. And I've got them in my office now.
No, that you know, I'm the same. I've got all sorts of stuff, even from the Second World War. You know, my grandparents writing to each other, that kind of thing. It's priceless, isn't it?
Yeah.
But I've got one final question for you, Steve. Is the question I always finish my interviews with, which is: are you a looking back or a looking forward kind of person?
I'm in the moment sort of person.
Yeah.
But yet at the same time, I'm a great believer in context. And obviously the past is the context. You know, I tell that to students, you know, if you want to understand Hindu nationalism today, you've got to go back and look at the historical context. So mostly in the present, but understanding the present is always founded on what's come before it. So, I mean, particularly now I'm, you know, retired and of a particular age, there's been more reflection recently about how on earth did I manage all this?
Well, you've got, but it sounds as though, and it's pretty clear, and I'm watching you obviously with all your books behind you as well. It sounds as though you've got plenty to keep you occupied in the many years ahead.
Yeah, I'm just starting my own website.
Wow. Well, there we are. Look, you're looking forward very much. Steve, what a wonderful opportunity to catch up with you again. Thank you for being my guest this week.
Yeah, great. Thank you so much, Chris.